Welcome back to the No Nonsense Sustainability Podcast. I'm Ildikó Ámási-Simcsik, and today we're in a special studio in Geneva, and we're discussing disaster risk reduction with Dr. David Dao from the UN University. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ildikó. I'm happy to be here. I hope it will be interesting for everyone.
Yeah, so we're here because of the Global Platform on Disaster Risk Reduction, right?
Yeah.
What is the Global Platform?
Basically, this is like, I mean, to make it very simple, it's like the COP, but only focused on everything related to disaster risk. So, you know, we try to not to say any more natural hazards. You know why, the story.
Yeah.
So, and that's why it's called disaster risk, actually.
Okay. So. Okay. And I know you're team leader at the UN University with a background in like physics, and you're developing AI. I was very surprised when I found out that a UN university is not an educational institution. So what is the UN University and what's your role within it?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. So basically, yeah, although we have the name university in, so we are like, let's say, the research arm of the United Nations, but we don't deliver any degree, let's say. We give some courses, but usually, so every different UN institution, depending on the country, they have a kind of agreement with the university. Let's say in our case, we have an agreement with the University of Bonn. And then we have a joint master program with them, actually on disaster risk as well. And then we also have like a PhD program.
Okay.
So, but eventually at the end of the day, they get their degree from the University of Bonn. We usually be like the first supervisor or the second supervisor, for example, in a case of a master or a PhD. And we give some courses, that's for sure. But yeah, that's it. At the end of the day, no, we're not a university. We are a think tank. We do more policy. And in our case, specifically at EHS, it's actually EHS because it's environment and human security.
Okay.
So that's what we do. So we really care about the environment, the human security. And so it's not just, because you asked me about my role, exactly. So it's not just the aspect of doing the research. So it's also the aspect of caring about the people, because we want their security as well. And we care about the environment. This includes eventually climate change. So my role as a scientist is actually, I'm leading a team on remote sensing and AI. And basically we use satellite data to try to help, like whenever a disaster risk happens, or like to prevent it if we can.
Yeah.
And so basically we use the satellite data to identify, for example, floods, like let's say shelters, and you know, depending on the event, if it's drought, flood, volcanoes, whatever, yes, you name it.
I came across your work in Bologna, where we were on the same panel for the International Association of Impact Assessment, talking about the different aspects of climate change. And that's where you mentioned XAI. Can you give a brief definition? Without the buzzwords, I wrote my buzzer. This is a special episode, so I'm not insisting, but we should still try to keep it jargon free.
Yeah, okay. I'll do my best. You know, it's not very easy to explain it, but okay. So in short, AI has a big problem of trust today, as you know. And so if you are like an AI developer, and you have doubts in some things, because you know that they are not working perfectly. We always say AI is not a silver bullet, right? So we don't have the solution all the time. But the idea is like, okay, let's do something instead of not doing anything. However, in this case, if you want to explain the AI for someone, and it depends who is this someone. So, you know, if you are explaining to the general public, it's something. If you are explaining to like a policymaker, it's something different. But at the end of the day, the goal is the same. You want these people to trust what you are telling them. Let's say in the case of disaster risk, Now you have a politician in front of you. It could be the prime minister or, like, I don't know, the head of the municipality, right? And then there's a flood and they have to take a decision. Like, do they evacuate? Do they ask the people to evacuate the city or the country or, you know? And then based on your model, your AI model, they will need to take a decision, but they are counting on you. Now, if they don't trust your AI model, because they will ask you a question, but how do you know, like...
Exactly.
How do you know there will be flood?
Exactly.
Do you, how much do you trust your, you know, your algorithm? Like, does it work 100%? Shall I tell the people now, like, to evacuate the city or the neighborhood? And, of course, the problem here is, like, since you are not sure, you know, you are running your AI, and then it's like a kind of black box.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't know why AI took that decision of telling you, for example, evacuate the people.
And so these are pretty serious decisions. Yeah,
indeed. I mean, there is no joke. If, for example, he says, let's not evacuate and then the floods arrive, you will have lots of people who will be dying. And at the end of the day, he's the one responsible, not you as an AI developer. So, so you know,
that's probably the only good thing about developing AI.
Indeed. So you don't have that responsibility, but indirectly you have it. I mean, you created the algorithm, right? So it's not that simple. So the whole idea behind the XAI is actually to explain AI and try to understand every step in the process, what happened, why AI took that decision and not like another one. So that's like, let's say, in short.
But so it's a very big decision tree.
Indeed. And then it depends on the type of AI. Some explainable AI works, some others don't work. So, you know, if you have like what we call the small AI or the basic AI, it may work. But if you are using like the big AI, like the large language models, for example, ChatGPT or like the Chinese DeepSeek, then there's no way XAI will work because it's very complicated. There are lots of neural network there, and neural network is like black box. Although you are the one who created the algorithm, you don't know what's happening. How do they communicate with each other?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why majorly, because if I tell you, okay, you have a traffic jam and then the cause of the traffic is because you have trucks. And so basically, okay, you say the solution, we ask the trucks like just to, you know, to drive during nighttime and then you fix the problem. But here you have one parameter that are the trucks.
Yeah.
But now in AI, instead of having one parameter, especially in the neural network, you have millions. Several millions. And then, of course, there's no way explainable AI can understand how these several millions are having impact on the decision. Maybe we will get there, but so far we're not there yet. So,
and as of today, with this explainable AI, what are the use cases for disaster risk reduction? Because as you said, a lot of it depends on this famous saying, garbage in, garbage out, is true for any kind of AI. So having the satellite images, having access to good quality data is obviously helpful. But as of today, what's a typical use case for the XAI?
Well, for example, you know, I didn't want to be very technical, but imagine
real life example maybe so that we could understand because this like understanding whether the flood risk is real and people need to move is very real.
Yeah. So let's take this, since we are talking about flood, let's take the flood as an example. Now, let's say there is a prediction and we know, let's say 90% a flood is coming. Okay. We know that from observing the satellite, the weather stations, you know, the models, the classical models based on physics, not just the AI models. So we are kind of like 90% sure there will be a flood coming. So now when you run your AI model, the AI will tell you, okay, there's 90% chance of flood. So you have to communicate this to the policymakers, and the policymaker, they have to take a decision. If there's flood, what do we do? If there are no flood, what do we do? Because if there are no flood, then basically everyone go to party, you know,
the best case.
Everyone enjoys their life. But now if there's a flood, then the policymaker, he has to take a decision or she has to take a decision based on like, okay, well, is this flood very strong, very brutal, or like it's just maybe, you know, it's flooding maybe a few millimeters and then everyone is fine. You have to tell the policymaker that, okay, we know 90% there will be flood, but 50%, we know that it will be like a huge flood or just like a normal flood. And then this is where AI is kind of lost. Like, okay, although you are using satellites, but even the satellites, you know, they have uncertainties, they have errors. So your data is not 100% sure. And then therefore, although you're trying to help at the end, maybe the policymaker will take a decision and no one is happy. But you know, you can apply that to something different. Like, imagine now you have crops, right?
Yes.
And you have the farmer, you know, does he gives like all the crops, does he give them water, yes or no?
Yeah.
And this is based on also your prediction. So basically, if you tell him no, there won't be precipitation, no flood, no whatever, you know, like probably he would say, okay, I'll give them water. But then the flood happens, and then because they got lots of water, so they die.
Yeah.
And then basically you killed the crops, but you killed his life as well.
Yeah. So I think in my presentation in Bologna, I also talked about some smart agriculture where you combine, it's like the Internet of Things with the remote sensing. So you pick up many different data points in real life, and then you could operate these like irrigation systems, for example, or you can make predictions about what to plant and when. But when it comes to disaster risk, like, yeah, flooding is one example. Can you give some other examples?
Well, you have lots of examples. Take the drought, for example, the volcanoes, you know, earthquake. These are like the things where basically, you know, we don't have, especially about earthquake. So there's no way really to monitor the earthquake. And therefore, your AI, even if you create an AI algorithm, it won't be able to help. At the end of the day, there's something, maybe the people, they don't realize it, but if there are no data, there is no AI as well.
Yeah.
But if your data is scarce, then also there is no AI.
What about synthetic data? That's like the data that AI makes up for itself.
Well, here you need to be careful. I mean, because, you know, well, you know, if the synthetic data is just because you are reproducing images of satellite.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we need to be careful here. You know, it's very difficult. I need to pay attention because if your satellite images are like very high resolution, then it means you will be able to see the people because you see in centimeters.
Yeah.
Although this data is not available for everyone, you know, but... So if the data is very like high, like super high resolution, then you cannot create synthetic data.
Yeah.
Because you will be, you know, like allowing also like not respecting the privacy of the people.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. But first, let me ask you. So are you saying that AI could predict volcano eruption?
I mean, it's possible. Maybe not again, you know. The question is always like, can AI do that? So again,
it
is it true or not? No, I don't think so. Not for the time being.
Okay.
Because again, you know, for some hazards, like take the landslides as well. So we are using also some AI to predict the landslides. But the data in these kind of things is very scarce.
Yeah.
So basically, even if you are using AI, and it may work in some area because you were lucky and you got some data, try to take the same model and apply it in a different area, definitely it won't work.
Yeah, and that's where the people and the local context and the local knowledge comes into play. I remember I had a project in Georgia in a very seismic area. It was known that it's seismic. They had landslides, they had debris flow, they had, you know, erosion with like whole trees coming down the hill. And the contractor said that they're going to build a camp, day camp somewhere. They set the spot. And the locals said that that's like the landslide area. Maybe you shouldn't construct it there, just put it somewhere else. But they didn't believe them. And they started building and it was covered. It was completely covered. Lucky no one was already in there and it was pre-construction. But that's really about the importance of this local context, because what we find is often there's really good data for some parts of the world or some parts of even a country, like regional differences can be huge. But then one thing that works in one context is completely useless in the other one. So how do you factor in the people and their local knowledge of these observations across like generations?
Well, you know, you hit the right nerve. So what I want to say is, like, we have in the past, I'm being like super transparent. I cannot be more transparent than that. In the past, we used to model for the people, not modeling with the people. And that's a big problem, because
can you explain the difference?
I'll give you an example. Like in one of the countries, without mentioning the country. So we were talking right now about volcanoes. So basically, in that country, we created a model for the volcano just by staying, you know, counting on the satellite images and then staying in our offices without communicating with the local people. And then eventually, our predictions turned out to be wrong, right? So we couldn't actually predict when the volcano is going to erupt, and suddenly it erupted and, you know, it caused lots of casualties. But then, you know, a few years after, we had the chance to go, we learned that we should sit down and talk to the local people. So we went there and we talked to the community there. And actually, we learned from them that the monkeys, they usually go close to the top of the volcano. And basically, before the volcano erupt, before like enough time to make everyone runs away, the monkeys start running down toward the village. And so for the local community, that was a sign to evacuate, because they knew like a volcano is going to erupt.
So they left.
So usually that's what they were using.
Wow.
To leave. So if we could, for example, if we knew that beforehand and we could include that in the model, because we could observe, you know, by, as you said, integrating some sensors there, observing with the satellite the movement of the monkeys, we could have eventually very easily with AI just send a message to everyone to evacuate.
Yeah, these are very complex issues. There are so many people involved, including the local community leaders, the local politicians. It's who's responsible for engaging with the people? Ultimately, because you're sitting in your office doing your models when they give you the data, but is it really your job to go there and do this? Is it part of the research, or is it someone else providing you with that data?
Well, you know, we are different teams. So eventually some people are in charge to go there. But, you know, sometimes you don't have the budget. You know, it's a money issue. And as I said, in the past, we didn't know that we could learn something from indigenous knowledge, from local communities, from First Nations, you know. Yeah. All these people, we didn't know that we can learn from them. We thought we are like super smart and like we know everything. And then basically with our model, we can fix the world. But it turned out like we were like super wrong, not just wrong. And then luckily today, things are not going like this anymore. So basically now everywhere we go, everywhere we have a study, we go, the first thing we do, we sit down with local communities. because each one of them, you know, they teach you something. Like another example, like in another country, we know there were lots of wildfires almost every year, and basically destroying a huge amount of lands. The model also there was wrong. But so we told, for example, based on the models, that's how you, where you put your trees, where you plant your trees.
Yeah.
And then it turned out we were planting the trees in a wrong way.
Oh, wow.
And then when we sat down again with the local people, then they told us, yeah, you didn't listen to us. We told your the people in charge back at that time, because they came here. We told them that's not how the trees were planted during, you know, their grandparents. And so they said, although we told you, you didn't listen to us. You kept on planting the trees in a wrong way. And basically, every year, the wildfires were increasing.
That's so incredible to imagine, because I know, obviously, when this happens, the policymaker is like, okay, we're just going to change the policy around this, like the fire safety zone, you know, and then you contribute to like a much bigger issue when it's ingrained in the policy, what people can and cannot do. And how do you walk back from that? Like, I know sometimes you were talking about models failing, and it must be like disappointing, right?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, also it's not easy on you as a person, because you feel responsible about what's happening. But again, you know, at that time, so we're talking many years ago, we didn't have that knowledge. And unfortunately, to be also honest, all the research, the studies were like this. So let's say the modelers who comes from mathematical or like physics or engineering backgrounds, they were not communicating with social scientists or like with the human scientists.
Yeah.
And even when you try to talk to them, they don't understand what you're doing. And basically for you, you think, you know, like, yeah, but what do they know?
I know it's two very different skill sets. That's why I was going to ask, like, you have the EAGES department that includes the human aspect and this like joint effort to understand each other and work together. I know I have a lot of technology guys in my company, and I really struggled initially to communicate because I didn't know enough about their stuff and they didn't know enough about my stuff. And we just did not speak the same language, like literally did not. And as you know, you said you sent people there to talk to the community. For us in social performance, that's a complete separate set of expertise. We go on trainings to be able to do that and get the complaints mechanism and, you know, like do the qualitative research of interviewing people, listening, the observations. How are you trained in your job? Is there trainings provided so you learn the basics?
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, that's like what I love actually, you know, in EHS. So this is amongst the thing, for example, in my previous life when I was working before, you know, with more like satellites and developing algorithms, we didn't have like basically honestly zero interaction with the people. And so basically we're just developing the models, right? While in EHS, it's totally different, because actually we are the minorities as developers, and the majority is like comes from social sciences background or human science background. And these guys, they are all like on the ground. And, you know, they go, as you mentioned, like before, like everywhere they go, they do surveys, they engage with local communities, they try to understand how things were, what they can do to help. And, you know, they learn from them as well. But we organize also training and capacity building. So from one side, you know, you learn from them, but from the other side, you also teach them something new. And this is what we call the transfer. So the two ways, knowledge transfer. And so that's actually amazing. But luckily, this is done at EHS. And this is something I learned at EHS, because beforehand, I didn't have that in mind even. You know, I told you, I think in the past, we were having a discussion that, yeah, I mean, it's impressive to, you can observe many things with the satellite, right?
Yeah.
And you can do probably magical stuff with AI. But can you, let's say, if you see some communities, you know, they are gathered with your satellite and you are using AI to predict, for example, their movement, right? Fine. Those two work. But if I ask you, do you know if these people are happy or what they are talking about?
Yeah.
That's something, unfortunately, neither your AI or your remote sensing would be able to do it.
Yeah. No, that's very true. And like, I think that's going to be like a big revolution when we figure out how to add this human layer. In my development, my approach is to have the human in the loop. The AI is an extension of a human, but it's ultimately the person that makes the decision. So it gives you the information, it gives you the background. And I know everything I develop currently is not predictive for a reason. For a reason.
I want to hear that.
Because it's hard. Even, you know, the compliance review, I'm working on some tools that would basically have to read a document and tell me if it complies with the standards or not. And as you know, like, some of it is, it's hard to quantify and hard to pinpoint. They were asking me to set up the criteria, and they were asking, like, how do you know in your work? And I'm like, I just know. I can't explain how I know. I just internalize this knowledge and I know. So that's why, you know, when you're dealing with these predictive things, how much of your intuition is incorporated? Have you ever had a case where AI told you something about disaster risk, but you were thinking, like, maybe this is off, maybe the truth is somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you always have doubts, because we talk about 90%, you know, all these numbers, right? But even if the prediction is 90%, you still have 10% as a no.
Yeah.
And sometimes the 10% is right and the 90% are wrong. And so eventually you are always scared when you do a prediction. This is your responsibility. But of course, at the end of the day, if, like, let's say the prediction is 90% of a volcano or like a tsunami or a hurricane, right? Then you will have to tell the politician you need to evacuate.
So you tell them that they need to evacuate, they don't, or do they make that decision?
They have to make the decision based on what your algorithm is saying, because they will ask you, well, are you like, what, 70% sure that there will be like a flood? If, you know, for them it's like 70% and beyond, then they prefer to evacuate in order to save lives, right?
And but how bad it has to be for people to evacuate? Because, you know, there's like, is it 70? Like, what's that? Is it set in some policy that if the risk is 75%, you need to advise them to evacuate? Or is it more, you know, qualitatively decided?
Yeah, actually, honestly, it's a very, very difficult question. So I don't know what to answer, really, to be honest. So I don't know what to say. I mean, for you, okay, as long as it's more than 50%, then there is like big chances. It means that you need to evacuate, and you prefer that you tell them to leave their homes and be safe than staying and then, you know, getting flooded or die.
Yeah.
Or being injured, or, you know. But you still have like 40% chance, let's say, of that there won't, nothing will happen, and you know they will still blame you.
Yeah, now, you maybe, you get blamed either way.
yeah, and then you know, well, I mean, the politician will be much more blamed than you because he's in the picture. I mean, you're not, but however, the politician also can hold you responsible for you know, you. You told them evacuate or don't, for example. So,
and what was your biggest like success story when your model predicted, people were saved, everything worked out?
Well, I mean, without now, you know, mentioning a place or, but yeah, I mean, many times we managed to save like people's life because the model worked perfectly, and then you know. They were told to evacuate, and then you know, I was like super happy. You cannot imagine. This is like reaching a point in happiness that cannot be described, because you know that, okay, you know, I came to work in this field actually to save people's lives and not to kill them, of course. And then so of course when it works, you're like, wow, you know. I need to go enjoy my life now, so everything is working perfectly. But yeah, you're still, however, you are always, eventually, you live with the fear that one day, you know, your algorithm may not work.
Yeah.
Because now imagine the opposite. Like, you do a prediction and you say, well, there are 90% chances of no flooding, and then the floods happen. Of course, this is like maybe with...
That the model is really off.
Yeah, that's it. With the technology today, I mean, it never happens. So, but imagine, you know, it's the case. I mean, you feel eventually very, very bad. And sometimes, like, you stay away from work for a while because you need also to disconnect or, you know, go see someone, talk to someone to... Yeah.
No, this is really interesting because I think just yesterday I was talking to someone about... how you measure success and your own performance as an expert in the environmental social performance. And I said most of my performance reviews were like, yeah, delivered X number of category projects, but none of those like went into detail what it meant to deliver successfully. For them, it meant the project is disclosed, the financing is approved, it's going forward. But there was nothing beyond that, like, have I done enough? Have I tried to go beyond compliance to give the maximum benefits for the people? And it's very, it might be very, very strange because also for you, if the model doesn't work, it's not necessarily your fault. It's a very, very complex ecosystem, right? Because it's, you know, the governments, the municipalities, do they care enough about it? If I'm just thinking about my own country, Hungary, we have floods every year, ever since I can remember. Why is it that in 2025, there's still people manually with their two hands move sacks filled with sand to stop the flood? When I work in this field and I know, like, one, it's predictable. Two, we know when it's coming, roughly, what time of year, where. Historically, it's been the same. And I know there are so many institutions that provide financing for disaster risk management, even for municipalities, not just the governments. So how do these projects find you? How do they find the UA University? How do you establish these relationships? Do they find you or do you find them?
Well, basically, to be honest, they find us much more than us finding them. It's because, you know, when you create, let's say, your model, you implement a project in a country, and then basically you have a success story there, it works. Eventually, when it works, everyone starts asking who created the model, who developed the algorithm, and which institution was that. And then, of course, then they find you, then they easily find you, and then you started being contacted by the first person, and then the first person, you know, they have also like connections, so they contact the other people, and then and so on. And that's how, you know, you build, let's say, your reputation. However, you know, it, as you mentioned, it's very complicated. So what's the success for you? Like in some projects, we do like predictions for 50 or 30 years from now, right? And for me, to be judged if you are successful or like you were not useful at all, talking, for example, about when you tell them implement this type of adaptation. But how do we know that like in 30 years, the adaptation doesn't turn out to be maladaptation?
That's a good question.
Yeah. And so, well, you know, we're not taking a decision based just on the model. As I said, you know, we go there, we have surveys, we talk to experts, scientists, but also the community leaders and, you know, about what they live, what do they think would be the best adaptation measures to implement there. And of course, based on all of this, then we take a decision. However, as I said, because you need to do something instead of waiting and not doing anything, because not doing anything, it means, you know, you are keeping the things will definitely, it will get worse. But, you know, do sometimes by doing something because you want to help, maybe you end up doing a maladaptation. But, you know, it's the only way also to learn.
Yeah.
So you make a mistake, you correct the mistake, and then, you know, things will become better. However, you are still causing damages at the end of the day. And so it's very, really critical. And that's why this fear, you always live with this fear. Okay, like for me, today you are judged and many institutions, they come, they run after you because, you know, you are doing maybe a good job. But for me, if I want to judge myself as a person, right?
Yeah.
I prefer like maybe to wait 30 years. By that time, maybe I'll be dead. But, you know, maybe I'll be alive and I want to see in 30 years from now if the adaptations we said, you know, should be implemented, they are really working.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, even if there's a prediction and they start going down that road, as you said, there was a big shift, even just integrating these human sciences, social people who do the consultation. And when we had the discussion, we talked about the primary data that's collected for projects that are funded by different organizations who have to publish these impact assessments. And that could be another source of valuable data. Currently, do you only collect your own primary data, or do you also rely on the country's data systems or other existing like information?
Actually, so all of that together. So basically, you know, there are satellite data. We have like, let's say, precipitation data. These are different than the satellite. So based on stations or like some radars or so.
Yeah.
So, but then you have also data that comes from the communities, the governments, you know, sometimes like local municipalities as well, that they are totally different. And then the data of the community usually serves a lot to validate what you are doing. Because without them, we will again fall into the same problem we had like 10 or 20 years ago. So luckily today, as I want to repeat it, that, you know, the good thing in EHS is like, you always validate the data with the local knowledge, local communities' data from these people. But, you know, sometimes now being a UN institution and having the blue flag helps a lot because everyone trusts you and, you know, they are ready to share the data with you. However, sometimes for other institutions, you know, they are complaining that, yeah, we want to do something good for this country or that city or that village, but they are not sharing the data with us because sometimes the data is sensitive. And so eventually they don't want to share it. And, you know, you understand. Basically, every village, every city should, you know, be the owner of the data. And this data should stay in that place. And it's up to these people to decide to share the data with you, yes or no.
And how much access do you have to the other UN databases? Because I know there's the big UN statistics, there's the UNEC data, there's specialized data for like various topics.
We have, honestly speaking, we have access to lots, really, really many types of data, you know, like it could be social data, economic data, you know, not just like satellite data or like, I don't know, any type of remote sensing data or, yeah, I mean, you name it. We have really access to, like, you know, it could be data, building data, really. So like, you know, we can locate actually, for example, every building in a city. So we have lots of access. And then the fact that you are in a UN institution, we always have the help, for example, the several space agencies who are ready to share with you usually classified data.
That must be quite mind-blowing, yeah, you know?
But sometimes, of course, they refuse to give you access to the data because the data is very expensive. And the UN, honestly, they can't afford to pay a huge amount of money to get, for example, just one image. And one image actually doesn't serve you a lot, doesn't help you. You need thousands of images, especially if you want to use AI. So like the big AI to be more specific. So.
And some of your general findings, how are they incorporated into the bigger UN policy agenda? Because there's like a UN agency or organization for like almost anything. And especially when we're talking about people living in areas that are vulnerable to climate change, whether that's like floods or droughts or whatever it is, how they're clearly very powerful to recommend policy changes or to fund interventions, create programs. Is there a communication? Is there some sort of knowledge exchange to kind of fine tune those initiatives?
Yeah, definitely. Like, as I said, we are like a research arm of the UN in general. So basically, many times, like, yeah, I didn't want to give names, but it's okay. I think they won't be. So like we have many programs with the WFP, so the World Food Program, UNDRR, so for disaster risk reduction. We had some projects with UNFCCC and then UNCCD. So like, you know, many really UN agencies, they reach out to us because that's what we are doing. So we are, they know that, okay, these guys, they were successful in many places, and eventually they know for us, the only interest is really to serve the people and to help the people. We don't have any other interest. It's not like, you know, we're not getting money out of helping the people.
Yeah.
So, and that's why they trust you. It's unlike being, you know, I don't know, like, say if you were a private, a big think tank company. So maybe, you know, they don't trust you because they will say, yeah, what if they want to benefit from what they are implementing? It could be like, you know, I don't know. You build a project and then after the project, you want to ask the people to take an insurance.
Yeah.
This is something we don't do.
Yeah. So like the other thing I wanted to ask is, are your studies ever used to influence infrastructure design? What I meant by like really big infrastructure in some of the projects that I worked on, huge dams that were not necessarily for energy generation, but for like flood control and river management. Have you ever done any project like that?
Look, it's not easy. So we, as I mentioned, like we had some projects where we did predictions and we said, okay, based on our research and our models, we think that's the best adaptation measures you should take in this city.
Okay. And that included some of this.
Indeed. So they have to implement, but we don't do the implementation.
Yeah.
So let's say the city will have to do the implementation, but like not everything today. Some things they have maybe the funds to do it today. Some other things need to wait maybe 20 years from now to so they are able to implement them. And so, of course, at the end of the day, they are listening to you, but yeah, I mean, again, you know, you judge yourself based on, for me, if this will be a success story, we'll know in 30 years or 50 years from now.
Yeah, and often it's not even your fault if it's happening or not, because I worked on some of those projects with municipalities that were disaster risk management, and I don't know if they work with you or somebody else, but they had some models, they had some predictions, and they were trying to design city level infrastructure to manage like increased water flow from the mountains or the seismicity or whatever. But then it somehow got lost with the middle management in politics. Yeah. Like it was not put on the budget for next year or the year after. And then next thing you know, it's 5 years delayed and you already had the flood and the infrastructure couldn't handle it.
It happens. And then to be honest, not just because now the people, if they hear us talking, they will imagine we are talking just about the countries in the global south.
No, that's it's not true. EU. You know? It's yeah. Very much EU.
Even sometimes in the global north, you know, it doesn't work because there are miscommunications. Sometimes, you know, you like in some countries, I don't want to name any country now, but in some countries there are conflicts. So let's say you have many institutions handling the early warning system. And so basically sometimes a miscommunication between the institutions launch at the end, like the early warning very late. But sometimes, as you just mentioned, because we did also some interviews in some of these institutions to understand what's happening. And sometimes it's actually the hierarchy that makes things slow, or like, because there's the decision maker, the person is not there.
Yeah.
And so everything stops. We're like, you know, sometimes they train some people and these people, they just leave because they found a better job and they were not replaced, or like they were replaced but the new person who arrived wasn't trained enough.
Yeah. And so these, like, just a little like explanation on these early warning systems, are they covering all sorts of disaster
in
risk?
Principle, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, you know, so basically when you establish an early warning system in any country, and I imagine nowadays the majority of the countries in the world, they have an established early warning system. However, I mean, you imagine, yeah, you have an early warning system for everything, but sometimes it doesn't work. I mean, and this is not, sometimes it's not really the mistake of the model or the mistake of the politicians. It could be because, you know, there were some clouds and the satellite didn't see anything. And basically, you know, the early warning system at the end of the day was not launched, or when it was launched, it was too late. So, you know, sometimes there are technical issues. Sometimes it could be like, the satellite is doing a maneuver. So, you know, we call that a maneuver when, like, there is an obstacle and then the satellite needs to go up or down, you know, its orbit. So basically you need to change the speed. And then when this happens, then of course you turn everything off. So, you know, it's not taking any more, like, any kind of images.
Yeah.
And if at that moment, you know, a flood is happening or, like, it's coming, then you know, you can't predict it anymore.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, I'm making it very simple, but
yeah, I can imagine.
Know, we
it's
have
a
many
lot
satellites
more complex.
Today. Yeah. 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 I mean, we have many satellites today. So basically it shouldn't be a problem. But there's always something, you know, like you don't expect. It could be a human error somewhere, you know, or like a miscommunication, or I don't know, like the data is not arriving anymore, or like while you know, some data today, you know, they are handled automatically in the sense of, you know, you like you just process the data very fast and then you get like the first images. But then you have the uncertainty is still high.
Yeah, and I guess with everything risk management, because we do to a certain extent, not like you, but in a different way, is the best case scenario is if they don't need to use the systems we put in place. So what I always say is it's not very PR friendly or sexy to put in a report that you have an emergency response plan. But when things go wrong, that's the thing that's most likely going to save you. And that's why, you know, when the priorities shift and the budget is tight, it's usually these invisible insurance policies that get cut and they focus on the more fancy things. But throughout this conversation, we talked a lot about the politicians, the countries, the organizations. How do you see the role of the private sector? Because surely they're the ones who are designing some of these infrastructures. You know, they could be inspired and they need to do some level of like risk assessment for whatever they design, whether it's a dam, it's the canal system for the solid waste management, seismic areas, roads, especially when you're like blasting through the, you know, like the mountains or hills. What is the role of private sector in all of this?
Look, we should think of a partnership, and this has to include the private sector, because also without the private sector, sometimes you cannot work properly. I'll give you an example. I know someone who has a company of drones, and these guys, they can deliver you in real time, actually, flood images. And these something like these, the kind of things you cannot get from a satellite, because it's too far, you don't see like the small details. And I said, some of the high resolution images, you cannot get them all the time. So you need these drones. And because these drones also, they help you to see like what's happening in the sense of, you know, they can fly where you cannot go, or where you cannot send people to go there. Even if it's a rescue team, you cannot send them before making sure it's safe. They can go there. So with the drones, you can see that. Another example of like the private companies, like, you know, the social media. You know, from the social media, many times you can save the people because they just put like on whatever the name of the social media, you know, they say, we are here, please come and save us.
Yeah.
And this is like super valuable as information. So these are tiny examples, but it's just to tell you again. So the UN institutions, the private partners, the private firms, companies, the local knowledge, the indigenous knowledge, of course, the modelers, the scientists, the researchers. So you need all these people, the policymakers, to be together. And this is the only solution, really the only solution. You cannot imagine work without this partnership between everyone.
I know we said we're not going to, but I'm going to buzz. Because my pet peeve is when everyone's talking about partnership, the policymakers, everyone should come together and do this together. But how? And you gave examples of the private sector providing the data, doing the investment in the technology that can make your data more reliable and help your work. And in my question, I asked more about the private sector integrating these considerations into their design of infrastructure that they build for the clients. Because sometimes the government, if they're getting loans from development finance institutions, they might get asked questions about climate change and I'm not going to say future-proofing, but a version of that. So how this infrastructure will maintain its shape and form and functionality when inevitably there will be changes in the environment. But sometimes the clients and the municipalities, they forget to ask this or to put this as a requirement for the tender for the designers. So then is that a responsibility of a company to, by default, look at this data and design infrastructure in line with the risks?
Yeah.
it's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually a very difficult question. It's very hard to answer it because I honestly don't know what to answer you. But
no,
it's like, look, imagine you have a family, right? And then everyone in this family, they have their own interest or like, you know, their own way of thinking. But now you want to keep this family together. So each member of this family has to accept that, okay, I need to accept the other and then stop asking for everything that I want just for me. And so if you are ready to say, okay, I'm ready to give up on this, and then it works in the family.
Yeah.
And for me, today, in today's world, we need everyone. We need everyone. It doesn't, I mean, you know, it doesn't, it's not going to work, especially in disaster risk.
Yeah.
It's not going to work, even if you think AI can do magical stuff, and then you go to like the best AI team in the world. If you don't have people on the ground, if you don't have private companies who are there also to, because the private companies, they always have the time to focus on things that you are taken by your job, by many responsibilities. You don't have the time to be like maybe as much as innovative as they are.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you need them. That's why you need them. And whose responsibility? I don't know. It could be my responsibility. It could be, I don't want to blame the UN. I cannot talk in the name of the UN.
This is
my own opinion. But I would say, let's say if there are funds coming towards me, then I should try as much as I can to involve all the partners. So whether they are private companies, firms, whether they are local communities, whether they are governments, policymakers. So you divide these funds in between everyone. And I'll give you an example. Recently, we applied for some funds and the funds are really like 200K. It's not much for a project. But we decided to give 100K for the local. So half of the money went to the local community. Because without them, we cannot do much. And so at the end of the day, we had also another partner. So we ended up by having maybe 30K or in the whole project.
Yeah.
But that's fine. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, we should accept that we need to include everyone in order to help because we know, okay, we have some knowledge, but our knowledge is limited to this and then, you know, to a specific range or also a specific time. Then who takes after you?
Yeah, exactly.
You need, I don't know, it could be an NGO, it could be a private company who will be like, okay, who, let's say, okay, you tell them, okay, let's implement these types of adaptation in your city, right? Who will do everything on the ground? It's not us. They need to have a private company, for example, who also will maintain the project. So I don't know, let's say you are building a dam. Who will maintain the dam? Because if you don't maintain it, then everything, you know, will be destroyed.
Yeah.
So that's why you need partners. You need partners. And then even let's say you don't have enough funds to have, I don't know, a private partner or like another, I don't know, UN agency, right? But you should say in your project, when you deliver the project and when you write the proposal, that in order for this project to be successful, you have to hire 1, 2, 3, 4 institutions. It's the only way to make it work. Without partnership, we don't have anything. And we were talking a bit before about the data, the ownership of the data, synthetic data, all of this. You cannot do that. You cannot have access to the data without this collaboration. Because let's say a private company is one of these big companies. You know, they come, they say, look, we have super infrastructure, we have super computing power, and we can do everything for you. We fix all the problem. in maybe a few days, which probably any other UN institution or academic institution won't be able to do. But these people, they say, we don't trust you, we won't give you the data. And that's why you need partnership. If this private company also comes with a UN institution or like, you know, an academia, then things will become different, because now they will give you the data because they know there is a UN flag there that says we will, you know, preserve this data, we'll protect it. And it will only be used whenever it's needed. And we will make sure, you know, they will use the data that doesn't violate, you know, any privacy of like that city or that country.
Exactly.
So, and that's why we need partnerships. You know, otherwise it's like we will stay handicapped and nothing will move. And we arrived really to a tipping point in climate, in environment, where we are really close. There is no return anymore. And then, you know, some other scientists are more still thinking positively that, yeah, we can do something to fix all these issues. But yeah, but we are definitely, we arrived to a point where we cannot continue like that. And then if we need the help, we need the help of everyone, all the people.
Yes.
Not just one country or like one company or one UN agency or, you know, one just local communities. We need to talk to everyone. We need to have projects everywhere. That's the only way to fix the problem. It might be, you know, very simplistic or idealistic, but no, these are facts. We are talking about facts. And that's the way, the only way to go forward. So,
yeah. Well, thank you. And I'm looking forward to our panel tomorrow that will bring together everyone, academia, international organizations, private sector. And I can't wait to discuss this further. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoy this episode. Let us know if you would have buzzed any other buzzwords. I know we were a little bit more lenient with that this time, but it was a special episode because of the global platform on disaster risk reduction. Thank you again, and I'll see you next time.